Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears back with you here. Getaway Friday, February the 18th, 2022. 14 coming up on 15 minutes past the hour. And on this eve of President's Day weekend, we are joined in studio by our favorite president here in Marion, Ohio, and certainly at WWGH, where the WGH stands for Warren G. Harding. A pleasure to be joined in studio by President Warren G. Harding, who was just about to read the creed of the Marion Star for us as we got into a little contretemps there about your personal life. You did it very politely, but the conversation, if you didn't hear it last hour, I had asked President Harding, which I have before in the meetings, about the 1920 campaign and what was really, what was the definition of the relationship between he and Kerry Phillips. And President Harding mentioned that I have brought this up before, and that it should not be asked of a president. I don't want to paraphrase what you said, but my response was, as a media man yourself, would you have brought these things up to a political person?
And in response to that, how do you, as an editor of a newspaper, how do you make those kinds of decisions? Of if there's some rumored impropriety, how do you address that in a way that's fair and in a way that's truthful? That situation comes up all the time in American journalism, where difficult decisions have to be made about how a story is going to be told, if a story is going to be told, and who's going to tell it. So, I established at the Marion Star what I called the Marion Daily Star Creed. It was posted on the wall. Every reporter and staff member knew it by heart. And I'd like to share that with you now, because I think this is a set of principles that guides that kind of decision-making. And more importantly, it's the kind of thing that has guided my ethics in politics. So this is it. It's just a series of points. The Marion Daily Star Creed. Remember, there are two sides to every question. Get them both. Be truthful and get the facts. Mistakes are inevitable, but strive for accuracy. I'd rather have one story exactly right than 100 half wrong. Be decent, be fair, be generous when you need to be. Boost, don't knock. There's good in everybody. Bring out the good, and never needlessly hurt the feelings of anybody. In reporting a political gathering, give the facts. Tell the story the way it is, not the way you would like to have it as a reporter. Treat all parties alike. Yes, there's politics, and it's going to be played. And if so, we will play it in our editorial columns, where it will clearly be labeled as our opinion, not fact. Treat all religious matter with reverence. If it can be possible to avoid bringing embarrassment to an innocent man, woman, or child by telling the misdeeds or misfortune of a relative, avoid that embarrassment. Don't wait to be asked. Do it without asking. And above all, be clean and never let a dirty word or suggestive story get into type. Because, and this is the final point, I want this paper to be conducted so that it can go into any home without destroying the innocence of any child.
The last point on this, because I don't want to harp on this, because we just heard the Marian Star Creed, and that's very interesting that President Harding came up with. On this whole subject of improprieties, which is what we just talked about, now, you came down on me a little bit for asking the question, but your creed seems to speak to what I did. I didn't ask your friends if they thought you did it. I didn't ask the Democratic Party if they thought you did it. I didn't find paperwork lying around to say that you did it or look for notes. I asked you, and I did not say, President Harding, you had improprieties. Why did you do that? I said, what was that relationship between you and Carrie Phillips? And you became defensive. Wasn't I doing what your creed states? Get both sides to every story. Go to the source. Realize politics are going to be played. It's not like I'm the first person who's brought this up here in the early 1920s.
Well, one of the things that the Marian Star Daily Creed doesn't address is the dignity of an American institution. Understanding, the Marian Star, it's a local newspaper. We're interviewing the dog catcher, we're interviewing the coroner, we're interviewing the auditor, we're talking about paving the streets that today are just mud. It's not a national newspaper. But when we were dealing with the American president, we're dealing not with the president, not only with the president as an individual, we're dealing with the presidency as an American institution. Involving trust, involving character, involving leadership, and these peripheral discussions of personal life, this or that, simply degrade the office of the presidency. This has nothing to do with Warren G. Harding. This has to do with the office of the presidency and the dignity that it should be regarded.
Let me ask this then before we move on to election night 1920. We're having a hard time getting to this, what happened there, but we're going to get there. But this is the final question on this, because maybe this is the more interesting question of this whole bit. And the names aren't even important here. But you, Warren Harding, you really only know the answers. I can only ask the questions. There's no hard proof of this at this particular point. You know what you've done. And speaking of this office that you hold, this president of the United States, and you came from Marion, Ohio, from humble beginnings, and you have rose to the highest office in the land, an office that does deserve dignity. I agree with you 100%. Honestly, do you consider yourself an honest, dignified man? Are you treating this office in 1922 with dignity and respect?
Absolutely. I have surrounded myself with members of the cabinet and political advisors that I know and trust, in some cases through a lifetime of relationships. I didn't interview strangers to appear on my cabinet. I built a cabinet based on trust in their competency, and in knowing them as people, in understanding their character. Those are the people that I've brought into the inner circle of the cabinet. And I am depending on the character, wisdom, and truthfulness that the cabinet brings to the office of the president.
Go ahead, caller.
I got a question for Mr. President.
Go, Mr. President is here. I will relay the question to him.
All right, thank you. I got a question. It's kind of off of what you guys are talking about, but I want to ask Mr. President, what is COVID-19?
And now, the COVID-19 is something that would have come along here in the 21st century, but I can tell you something that President Harding can speak to is a pandemic that went on right before he went into the office, which would have been the pandemic of 1918. Correct, President Harding?
Yes, it's
correct. I just want to know. I knew that part.
1922, and yet we're still feeling the effects of the panic that went with the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. It's been a grisly few years. We're near the end of it, although there are still casualties. But so far, we've lost 700,000 lives in the United States to this disease, and estimates vary worldwide. Some put worldwide losses at 50 million, and others factor in undeveloped countries where record keeping isn't good, that the estimate may go to 100 million lives lost worldwide because of this Spanish flu pandemic. It first appeared in the United States in 1918 at an army base in Kansas. I can't recall the name of the base, but it's one of the bases used for training purposes. That was unfortunate because as they see a lot of new recruits coming in for training, and there was one case there, and that case was with one of the cooks at the camp. Well, you can imagine what happened. That cook was a spreader of this pathogen, and it spread like wildfire among the trainees. Those trainees were deployed to other countries, and it just exacerbated the spread of this disease. Not that it was caused by the United States. It originated in Spain, but it swept the country within a matter of months, and it completely overwhelmed hospitals and doctors' offices. It meant that tent clinics were set up in most cities across the country with volunteers taking care of the sick. Understanding this is an illness that there's no treatment. It's the flu. The only treatment is cold compresses to keep the fever down, keeping them well hydrated with liquids. Aspirin is the only thing available to alleviate pain and discomfort. But other than just treating symptoms, there is no cure for this. It simply has to run its course, and it's led a devastating course through this nation. And we're still reeling from the effects of that.
Do want to let the listening audience know you can call in. Now remember, President Harding is in the time of 1922. Everything up to 1922 he can speak on here, and anything directly to do with his life. 740-383-9944. Last caller, I lost you. We got disconnected in the midst of that call about the pandemic. So if there was more to that, do call back in, because we do want to get the rest of your call in. And then we had another caller there who I think didn't want to interrupt the president while he was speaking. So give us a call back. 740-383-9944. But we are in the time of 1922 here, so anything up to that point is fair game, which is pretty much by and large all of the president or all of the Harding presidency. 740-383-9944, and we'll break in if you call. 740-383-9944. Now the Election night, 1920, you're back in Marion, you're over at the Harding home, you're listening to KDKA from Pittsburgh to get the election results. When do you hear that you're going to be the next president of the United States, and is there a confidence that day in Mrs. Harding? Is there a confidence? Who's in the House with you?
Well, the House is packed with, it's, as you can imagine, it's a big party. We've got all of the campaign strategists with us. We've got my campaign manager, Charles Christian. We've got my campaign advertising and public relations person, Albert Lasker. We've got representatives from the party. Mark Hanna is the party boss for Ohio. He's here. We've got supporters from every direction. Ears tuned to the radio. We're all listening to the same thing. And hearing the results coming in, that it's... I started out ahead and maintained that lead as a... everybody's calling it a landslide. Some have called it the greatest landslide since the institution of the two-party system. One with a margin of 60.3% to Mr. Cox, who had 34.1%. As the electoral votes were being counted, my electoral count was 404 versus Mr. Cox had an electoral count of 127. So it was... Some would say a lopsided result. Others would say, well, it was a landslide.
Now, we should remember that Mr. Cox is an Ohioan, just like you. He is a newspaper man, just like you. What, he's a white man, just like you. What is the big difference in voters' mind?
Well, it's part of it is platform. To be honest, I haven't worried much about what Mr. Cox is doing. I have not attacked him. I have not denigrated his platform or his point of view. I have not spoken his name in any of my campaign work. Mr. Cox and the Democratic Party will do what they will do, and the voters will decide for themselves who is the most appropriate person to select to lead the highest office of the United States. He is a staunch Democrat, just as I am a staunch Republican. He adheres to the Democratic platform. In all its forms, and it would be unseemly for me to criticize him.
Let me say this, because I have met him on a couple of occasions, and what is interesting is, as we said earlier, you come from humble background, but you seem much more of a well-dressed, refined gentlemen, and we have to remember that 1920 was the first presidential election that women had the right to vote in. You obviously have a very strong, smart wife in Florence Harding. Everybody is aware of this. Mr. Cox seems fast-talking. He seems bombastic, certainly more than yourself. He seems much more willing to share his opinions. When somebody asks him a question, the voice changes. You know, he's there. Is my depiction of him right?
Well, your depiction is your opinion. It's your editorial. Everybody is entitled to their own editorial. Many would agree with your characterization of Mr. Cox. I've heard some describe him as rough around the edges. He certainly has a healthy ego, and that's apparent in his public appearance. But again, I refuse to criticize Mr. Cox or denigrate any of his accomplishments. The voters will make their decision about what's best.
Both being Ohio men and politicians, was there ever any connection? Did you two ever have any connection in your lives? Did they touch at any point?
Only vaguely. We were both members of the Ohio Press Association. I knew the editors and publishers of the newspapers of Ohio and somewhat beyond. So he is well known within the journalism professional community. But I only knew him in that way.
Election night 1922, when did it come down that you were the winner?
Well, it came down late in the evening, about 11:30 as I recall, which is remarkable given the state of communications in 1920. But radio certainly moved that along and made it more of a real-time enterprise rather than waiting days or weeks for vote totals to come in from the states and the electoral college. It became almost instantaneous, and that had never happened before.
Big celebration that night?
Oh, major celebration. We had, somebody counted, 200 cakes that were brought to the home, and we devoured them all.
you giving the speeches on the front porch, what one more thing on the front porch campaign. In this day and time, were you just a projectional speaker? There a lot of people showed up in the area, and not a lot of amplification devices, very crude at this time in this era. How could people hear you in these crowds?
Well, the only way anybody could hear me was to project. And another word for that is shout. But anybody who is trained and practiced in oratory learns how to do that. It's done with breath support, pacing, and it's the art of shouting at people without shouting at them.
Do you think people way in the back heard you?
Yes, I believe so.
It carried.
I believe so. Any political figure of my era and prior, that was the only vehicle available, was to just do everything you could to be heard. And sometimes these were crowds of 10,000 people or more. You can imagine people 100 yards, 200 yards away, you know, packed earmuff to earmuff, waiting to listen to the president or a candidate. But it's an oratorical art to be able to do that and still retain your humanity.
You know, here's something I don't think we've ever talked about. Just to give reference, Theodore Roosevelt, how you kind of came to the presidency. Theodore Roosevelt, very popular Republican presidency, comes in because another Ohio president was assassinated. Did you have any association, admiration for William McKinley?
Yes, I did. In fact, I didn't mention his name, but William McKinley is who I modeled my front porch campaign after. I always admired William McKinley's approach. I admired his campaign strategy, the humbleness of it, the simply unpretentious. In fact, the flag and the flagpole at the Harding home is from the William McKinley home.
So Theodore Roosevelt, his vice president, assumes office. By all accounts, becomes more popular than maybe even William McKinley was. Decides he's not going to run again. Leaves. Another Ohio man comes in, Taft. Roosevelt chooses him. They're buddies. And then Roosevelt does not like Taft. He wants back in office. So we get the three-way race of Wilson, Roosevelt, and Taft, which essentially hands the presidency to Woodrow Wilson. Sends Roosevelt into a bit of a depression. Taft into a little bit of a depression, too, because of the nasty things that were said during that election. And I'm drawing up to this just so everybody knows the question I'm going to ask and has the background. It was thought, and we've talked about this before, that Theodore Roosevelt, he had mended his fences with the Republican Party. Taft certainly does not want to run again for office at this time, and it's going to be Roosevelt. He's mended his fences in 1920. He has even written that he wants to do this. He thinks he's going to do this. He thinks he has the backing. And that's why this 1920 Republican convention is such a mess that nominates you, because Roosevelt was thought to be the guy going in, but of course he dies prior to this. Now, where I'm leading up to this, William Howard Taft, what was your feeling on him right now? Former President Taft.
Well, let me just get right to the point. We have a Supreme Court justice today that is ailing and likely will need to be replaced in the very near future. And William Howard Taft, I'll just announce this publicly on the radio now, will be my lead nominee for the Supreme Court. So whatever injustice may have been done during campaigning and fractured relationships, I think a position on the Supreme Court may atone for that and will give him the opportunity to leave a lasting legacy for this country.
You guys, you and Taft, at this point in 1922 have a lot of commonalities. Again, Ohio guys, now presidents. He was president. You're the current president. Is there any kind of relationship there? Is it a friendship? Have you met? Was he anywhere in the campaign of 1920?
No. We had a reciprocal relationship of mutual admiration, but we didn't have a personal relationship. I admired his stance, his diplomacy, his point of view, his platform. His character as a human, but I had an opportunity to meet him on many occasions as a senator, but I had no personal relationship with Mr. Taft or his family.
So this nomination is not based in a friendship or a reverence for this former president. You think he's best suited to do this job?
Absolutely. It's people underestimate the legacy that Supreme Court justices leave because they serve for life, and they enable court opinion that establishes the direction of American society for decades and decades to come. Honestly, I think Supreme Court justices leave as big or maybe even a bigger impact on American society than the president does. It's a very powerful and meaningful position to hold.
One final thought here, because I do want to get a speech in this hour of your choice, but when it comes to Taft, it is interesting because he precedes you as president, and during the election that elected Woodrow Wilson, there was, speaking speaking of newspapers and campaigning and nasty things, inappropriate things being said about a current president, we obviously talked about picadillos involving you, but boy, Taft got hit very, very, very hard about his weight. And about, you know, his weight is not a policy. His weight is not anything to do with his job. Was there anything in the Marion Star about that as a journalism man? Do you think that was fair?
No, I don't think it's fair. We're talking about a personal characteristic that has nothing to do with anyone's competency, fitness for office. Yes, he was a man of some girth. So was Grover Cleveland. And I'm not a thin man myself. So making someone's physical stature an issue that affects the politics is completely inappropriate.
And Theodore Roosevelt was pretty much the guy who led the charge on that.
And I believe it was wrong of him to do that.
And just to wrap this up, because I think this is an important point, former President Taft, you've announced Supreme Court Justice Taft, but some people feel that in 100 years, if you say the name Taft, people are not going to know any of that. What they're going to know is that he was a big man. That will become his defining characteristic in history. If you don't know anything else about Taft, you know he was our biggest president, the one who weighed the most. What does that say? Much like the picadillos that you've been asked about, these become defining characteristics in public. The cap that Theodore Roosevelt wore. Silly things like this become important to us. Why?
You know, isn't that human nature? We find it's what drives the news business. It's what's unusual. It's what's sensational. It's what's out of the ordinary that captures our attention. You know, the fact that daily life goes on, the mechanics of politics and business, is the routine of our daily lives is overlooked.
Would you think in 100 years that Taft will be remembered for his weight more than anything else?
That may well be. I'd like to think that some of his greatest accomplishments may be yet to come through his Supreme, assuming he's seated on the Supreme Court and his nomination is ratified in Congress and in the Senate. But assuming that, I think he'll have a lasting legacy in his Supreme Court opinions.
Think if Lincoln had never wore the tall hat. Well, how would we ever, you know, depict him?
Well, that's it. The you think of Lincoln, you think, and I'm going to lean back on the advice of Albert Lasker, my advertising person. You think about his brand. You don't think of a president as having a brand, but Albert Lasker, when he came on to our campaign, he said, "I'm going to market Warren G. Harding like a 5-cent pack of gum," and he did just that. So the Lincoln's hat was his brand. Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Rider persona was his brand. And if you're a student of history, you'll understand that it's completely manufactured.
Let's take this call. Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, how are you doing this morning there, Mr. President?
President's doing good, I think.
Okay. And kind of coincidental, yesterday I mentioned something about the weight of President Taft, which is in the encyclopedia, that he did weigh 300 pounds. There was a question asked how
he was stuck in the bathtub, and the person running the show said that that's kind of, I don't know how to put it, but he could put soap around him and get out. But it wasn't that. It was during something that he had. Where I obtained that information come from the encyclopedia. And maybe all of us involved in getting information gets it on different tools that is presented to us in this era. But I don't think that this is a reenactment. And I wonder if I could ask a question to President Harding, if he can recall on his front porch speech, was there any Indians there?
President Harding, when you were giving the front porch speeches, were there any Indians there?
Yes. There were a number of Native Americans, if that's what you're referring to.
No, a number I'm of Native Americans. Was there any Indians there? And was there a chief?
Some came in in envoys on the train, where there would be a number of representatives from their various tribes, because they were interested in what our administration's policy would be regarding Indian affairs, Western lands. So they had their own interests, just as every American had interests, maybe very different ones. But I considered the Native American a significant constituency for the Harding presidency.
President Harding, we've got about 10 minutes left in this hour. I wanted to get to a speech here. Whichever one you would like to enlighten us with.
Well, I have several. You think, well, what are presidents going to be remembered for? And Mr. Lincoln may be remembered for the hat. And Warren Harding may simply be remembered as someone who was loud, because I had to project in speeches. And just as an aside, let me mention that at the inaugural address, it was the first time that a sound amplification system was used for a presidential event. And I can tell you from behind the scenes, it was an amazing thing, where trucks full of equipment, vacuum tube amplifiers and so forth, were brought in by the Bell Telephone Company. The Bell Telephone Company had pioneered this sound amplification technology, so they arrived with amplification trucks and microphones and speakers, and we had an estimated audience of 20,000 people on the Mall at the inaugural event, and I was on the east portico of the Capitol building with a big microphone in front of my face, and that was the first time that had ever happened in the U.S. presidency. But with regard to a speech, well, actually, I'll let you make the choice.
Okay.
All right? There are a couple different places that I can take you. I can outrage you with the injustices of racism in the United States. I can make you angry. I can make you cry. With the address I gave at the dedication of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, that just happened in November of 1921. So you tell me, do you want to be outraged, or do you want some tears?
Let's save the outrage for next hour. We'll fit that one in.
Okay.
So we will go. This is the dedication speech for the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier.
So imagine, here we are. If you've ever been to Arlington Cemetery, imagine we're standing there at Arlington Cemetery. We're near the amphitheater. And we're gathered around a rectangular box of granite and marble, guarded by two soldiers at attention, there are maybe 15,000 of us. As far as you can see. And I'm addressing this group to put into context what we have before us. Ladies and gentlemen, we are here today to pay the most impersonal of tributes. The name of him whose body lies before us took flight with his imperishable soul. We know not whence he came, but only that his death marks him with the everlasting glory of an American dying for his country. He might have come from any one of millions of American homes. Somewhere, some mother gave him in her love and tenderness, and with him her most cherished hopes. Hundreds of mothers are wondering today, finding a touch of solace in the possibility that the nation bows in grief over the body of one she bore to live and die, if need be, for this republic. For in this body, there once glowed the soul of an American, with the aspirations and ambitions of a citizen who cherished life and all its opportunities. He may have been a native or an adopted son, that matters little, because they glorified the same loyalty, they sacrificed alike. We do not know the eminence of his birth, but we do know the glory of his death. He died for his country, and greater devotion hath no man than this. He died unquestioning, he died uncomplaining, with faith in his heart and hope on his lips, that his country should triumph and its civilization survive. As a typical soldier of this representative democracy, he fought and he died, believing in the indisputable justice of his country's cause, conscious of the world's upheaval, appraising the magnitude of a war the like of which had never horrified humanity before. Perhaps he believed his to be a service destined to change the tide of human affairs. In the death gloom of gas, the bursting of shells, the rain of bullets, men face more intimately the great God over all of them, with the din of battle, the glow of conflict, and the supreme trial of courage, they came involuntarily, the hurried appraisal of life, the contemplation of death's great mystery. On the threshold of eternity, many a soldier wonders how his ebbing blood would color the stream of human life, flowing on after his sacrifice. Indeed, I revere that citizen whose confidence in the righteousness of his country inspired belief that its triumph is the victory of humanity. This American soldier went forth to battle with no hatred for any people in the world, but hating war and hating the purpose of every war for conquest. He cherished our national rights. And in the maelstrom of destruction and suffering and death, he fired his shot for liberation of the captive conscience of the world. On an occasion as this, amid such a scene, our thoughts alternate between defenders living and defenders dead. A grateful republic will be worthy of them both. Our part is to atone for the losses of heroic dead by making a better republic for the living. Sleeping in these hallowed grounds of Arlington Cemetery, in the grounds that surround us here, are thousands of Americans who have given their blood for the baptism of freedom and its maintenance, a country better and nobler for their deeds. Burial here is more than a sign of the nation's favor. It's a suggestion of a tomb in the heart of the nation, sorrowing for its noble dead. Today's ceremonies proclaim that the hero unknown is not unhonored. We gather him into the nation's breast, within the shadow of the Capitol, within the shadow of the towering shaft that honors Washington, the great father of our nation, and of the exquisite monument to Lincoln, most recently constructed, a monument to the martyred emancipator. Here, the inspirations of yesterday and the conscience of today forever unite to make the Republic worthy of his death for flag and country. Ours are lofty resolutions today, for with tribute to the dead, we consecrate ourselves to a better order for the living. With all my heart, I wish we might say to the defenders who survive, to the mothers who sorrow, to widows, to children who mourn, that no such sacrifice shall ever be asked again. It was my fortune recently to see a demonstration of modern warfare. It's no longer a conflict in chivalry. Warfare is no more a test of valiant manhood. Today, it's cruel, it's deliberate, it's scientific destruction. In this demonstration of armaments, there was no enemy, only the theoretical defense of a hypothetical objective. But the attack was made with all the relentless methods of modern destruction. There was the rain of ruin from the aircraft, the thunder of the artillery, followed by the unspeakable devastation brought by bursting shells. There were mortars belching their bombs of desolation, machine guns concentrating their storms of lead. There was the infantry advancing, firing, and falling. The flying missiles were revealed by illuminating tracer bullets so that we could note their flight and we could appraise their deadliness. The air was streaked with tiny flames marking the flight of mass destruction. As this panorama of unutterable destruction visualized the horrors of modern warfare, there grew on me the sense of the failure of a civilization which can leave its problems to such a cruel conclusion. Surely nobody in authority could ask the entire manhood of a kingdom, of an empire, or a republic to make that kind of sacrifice until all reason had failed, until appeal to justice through understanding had been denied, until every effort of love and consideration for fellow man had been exhausted, until freedom itself and inviolate honor had been brutally threatened. I speak not as a pacifist, not as a pacifist fearing war. I speak as one who loves justice. I speak as one who believes the highest function of government is to give its citizens the security of peace, its citizens the opportunity to achieve, and the pursuit of happiness. The loftiest tribute we can bestow today is the commitment of this republic to an advancement never made before, to put mankind on a higher plane, with war's tragedies barred from the stage of righteous civilization, where reason and righteousness shall prevail. Standing today on hallowed ground, as we are, it's fitting to say that his sacrifice and that of the millions dead shall not be in vain. There must be, there shall be, the commanding voice of a conscious civilization against armed warfare. As we return this poor clay to its mother soil, garlanded by love and covered with the decorations that only nations can bestow, the prayers of our people, of all peoples, shall mark the beginning of a new and lasting era of peace on earth. Goodwill among men. Let me join in that prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever. Amen.
President Warren G. Harding is the guest. We're going to break for 15 minutes. We're coming back. We've got the speech involving race that you are not going to want to miss. Remember, this speech was given in the 1920s by our man, President Warren G. Harding. We're also going to talk about Calvin Coolidge. I don't know that we've ever done that either. The man who's vice president of the United States. Did he and President Harding ever share a moxie? We'll talk a little bit about that and maybe get a little bit of trivia in here on the in the third hour and final hour of the morning. Boy, the time goes by so fast when you have a president in the studio. Warren G. Harding. Stay tuned.
He is survived by his siblings, sister-in-law, nieces and nephews. Visitation will take place on February 22nd at the Snyder Funeral Home, 360 East Center Street, from 10 to 11 in the morning. Funeral service will follow at 11 with Pastor Brad Smith officiating. Burial will be in Grand Prairie Cemetery. You may leave an online condolence at Snyder Funeral.